What's a professional football player to do when the NFL is trying to work through its lockout? How about teach math and social studies? That's what David Bruton of the Denver Broncos did. In April, since he didn't have official practices, he started working as a substitute teacher, working with kids from first grade through high school, including at his alma mater. And now that the school year's ended, we were able to catch up with him. He joins us from Yellow Springs, Ohio. David Bruton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what's scarier, facing Randy Moss running down the sideline or a room full of first graders?
I'm going to go with the elementary kids, for sure. Full of energy and try to play.
What gave you the idea?
My coach from high school gave me the idea, along with a couple of my friends who are teachers in the high school. And I wasn't hesitant by any means to pursue that chance to teach at my alma mater.
What made you think, or what made them think, that you'd be a good teacher?
I believe that is the fact that I was a good student in high school, and I was a good student in college, and they saw me as a good role model. So they weren't afraid to ask me, and the school needed teachers.
What are your good qualities that you think? Are you patient, good at explaining things?
I feel like I'm pretty patient, especially you have to have a lot of patience with the younger kids, as well as if I don't know the answer, I've always been taught to do whatever it takes to find the answer. And I've definitely had to put that into fruition with math, especially geometry.
Well, you know, I noticed that you majored in sociology at Notre Dame, so it makes sense that you would teach social studies, but math?
Math was definitely not expected by any means. It's been forever since I've taken math. It's been my freshman year in college was the last time I took math, and that was in the summer.
Well, so you had to brush up.
Oh, yes. I was definitely in the books. I was definitely on my iPad looking up how to figure out quadratic equations and find out angles and just a lot of stuff that I haven't done in quite some years.
Well, it sounds like you took it very seriously.
Oh, yes. I definitely think that teachers are definitely the guiding source of our youth, and there's no sense for anybody in that position to take it lightly.
I imagine that you were probably very popular at recess.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What did the kids want to do with you?
They wanted to
Did they want to play football? They wanted to play kickball.
Kickball. We divided the teams up, and, you know, I couldn't join a specific team, so I was an all-time pitcher. There was no way I was throwing a no-hitter versus them. They were catching everything I threw.
They can really kick.
Oh, yes. Yes, they can.
How come they like kickball so much?
I don't know. I think when I was younger, I used to love to play kickball as well, just the way to see how far you can boom the ball and run around the bases as fast as you can.
So speaking of where we started out, which is scarier with a room full of first graders or, you know, facing, you know, somebody like Randy Moss, at the end of the day, when you got home from work, when were you more tired, training camp or teaching elementary school?
Teaching elementary. I came home and I passed out. I didn't walk my dog. He was just sitting there laying, barking. I was dead.
Because why? Because you're on, what, all day as opposed to just when you're called upon to play? I guess what I'm asking you is that not many people have the experience that you've had. I mean, all of us have had a teacher at some point, but very few people have stepped on the other side of the desk. And so what can you tell us about the experience that perhaps people don't really understand about teaching?
It's constantly moving, constantly keeping the students engaged. From the second graders, you got to play games or do something to keep them active and keep their attention. And as far as high school, you go around helping them out individually. And you're constantly using your brain, especially teaching stuff that you, in my position, haven't done in 6 years.
It's a sensitive question, but I'll ask it. Based on what you know, do you think perhaps teachers should make more money?
I believe the teachers should definitely be compensated more, especially, like I said, they're the guiding path for these students now. They're basically the providers for the parents when they're not around. They have the kids all day, 7 hours, 8 hours a day, and they have to teach them and get them ready for life, basically.
I understand that you're also planning to take the GREs and the LSATs, so I get the impression then you're planning to continue your education after your playing days are over, perhaps even while you're playing in the off season. What are your plans, if you don't mind my asking?
I want to pursue perhaps family law or some form of social work. And now the idea of teaching has definitely crossed my mind.
Is there also in part, I mean, I understand that you did this for you because you thought you'd be good at it, but I wonder in part, would you also like to present perhaps a different image of the athlete? I mean, we haven't had so many great stories about people in your line of work these days, if you get my meaning.
Oh, yes. Athletes are different from from the bottom to the top. It's a lot of guys do a lot of charitable work. A lot of guys do a lot of work in classrooms or juvenile centers or, you know, in different countries with stuff. An athlete is not just a bad guy who happens to have a big checkbook. It's some guys are guys with a lot of heart and desire, and stuff that they're made of is different than a lot of people foresee.
So you think people have the wrong idea, the image perhaps that they have needs adjustment?
Oh, yes, because you never hear much about good publicity about athletes. It's always the negative stuff that becomes nationwide news. You see of a football player with a, or an athlete of some sort with a DUI, but you don't necessarily hear about Champ Bailey having a camp in Denver or some form of Christmas get-together nationwide. You know, it's just how the media perceives things.
Well, thank you for giving us a different image. We appreciate that. And
no,
if the unfortunate occurs and that there is no season, what do you think? Do you think that they'll see you back in the classroom in the fall?
Yes, I'm actually looking forward to maybe possibly doing it this summer if need be. My license is for a year long, so I got a whole year to continue teaching.
So you actually got your license?
I got a year-long substitute teaching license. Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
David Bruton is a safety for the Denver Broncos and a substitute teacher. You heard him. He has his license at Jane Chance Elementary School. And is it Miamisburg?
How do you pronounce?
Ma'am. Miamisburg High School in Ohio. And he was nice enough to join us from Yellow Springs, Ohio. David Bruton, teacher. Mr. Bruton, thank you so much for joining. As you would say, like the kids call, did the kids call you Mr. Bruton? How do they say it? Tell me what they
Mr.
say.
Bruton.
Mr. Bruton.
It took a while to get used to.
Mr. Bruton, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Ryan Brooks, Bridget DeShagas, Sanaj Meshkinpour, Amitha Parashar, Lena Moses-Schmidt, Amy Ta, and Saran Yitbarik. Our intern is John Ketchum. Our editor is Alicia Montgomery. She had a hand this week from Kyle McKinnon and Laurie Grant. Our directors are Monica Evstatieva and Arjun Hutchins. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. Our technical director is Brian Jarbo. He had a hand this week from Sean Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The executive producer is Tashima Walker. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.
This week marks the anniversary of a mark you may be wearing on your shoes right now. 40 years ago, Carolyn Davidson showed her boss a little drawing of a curved check on a piece of paper.
I remember when he picked the swoosh, he said, "I don't love it, but it'll grow on me."
The swoosh, the man smothering Carolyn Davidson with that faint praise for it 4 decades ago, was Nike co-founder Phil Knight. And the drawing the shoe mogul hastily selected was the iconic image that graces all his company's footwear, boxes, and ads today.
At the time, Carolyn Davidson had no idea how much to charge for the swoosh. Her assignment had been to come up with a logo for the running shoes. She was a novice and asked for a $35 fee for the drawing. Since then, Nike has made billions. Eventually, the company gave her some stock. She's not quite a millionaire, she says, but she's famous. Sort of.
I've pretty much stayed under the radar, and nobody knows who I am.
Davidson was a college student when Phil Knight hired her for his company. She says that one day Knight stumbled upon her sitting in a hallway of Portland State University in Oregon. She was telling a friend she didn't have enough money to take an oil painting class. Knight hired her as a graphic designer. And a few years later, that's how she came to create one of the world's most memorable corporate logos.
when I see it on TV and I turn on a game and both teams are in Nike, I mean, I just get a good feeling. Or if I turn a corner and run into a billboard, or if I watch the Olympics. I mean, it's just a good feeling inside.
That's Carolyn Davidson, creator of the Nike Swoosh, born on a bit of tissue paper in 1971. Of all the world's runners who wear Nike brands, there is one person who is not in their number.
I like to walk, I like to garden, but I never was into running.
More coming up from All Things Considered.
It's Friday morning on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The housing market is still languishing this summer. There are economists who say prices won't start to recover until 2014. And Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke said this week that the housing market may be worse than most people had thought. A big part of the problem is what's being called the shadow inventory, the millions of homes that soon will be up for sale. But NPR's Chris Arnold reports on one glimmer of hope amidst all the bad news.
On any given day, in just about every city in the country, auctioneers are standing on the front steps of homes selling off foreclosed properties. Houses like this one, an older wood-shingled house in a bit of a tough neighborhood in Boston.
I, Archie Natakioni, turning authorized agent for Deutsche Bank National Trust Company as trustee for HSIS.
Often, no buyers even show up, and the bank just takes the house. 5 years after the housing bubble burst, the numbers are still staggering. And the crazy thing is how many houses are still in the foreclosure pipeline and haven't even come up for sale.
In a worst-case scenario, you're looking at potentially 6 million of these properties.
Rick Sharga is with RealtyTrack, which follows this shadow inventory. He says there are more than a million homes in foreclosure that haven't been sold. On top of that, there are 4 million seriously delinquent home loans.
The majority of those will ultimately hit the market as distressed properties, another part of that shadow inventory.
Sharga says at the current pace of foreclosure sales, it would take more than 9 years to sell all these homes. Until then, they could keep glutting the market and putting downward pressure on prices. So that sounds pretty bad.
And the numbers, frankly, aren't terribly encouraging.
Still, most analysts don't think that the housing market is going to stay in the dumps that long. And here's one reason why they're a little more hopeful. It's what economists call household formation. That is, when people, say, get out of school or they get married and move out of their parents' house for the first time, that creates demand for housing. Carl Case is an economist at Harvard University.
If you look at the number of households in the country, that's been growing at a rate of about 1 million to 1.5 million a year, quite steadily.
Case says, though, that during this economic downturn,
all of a sudden that seems to have stopped, that process of generating new households. And we don't really know why yet.
Household formation is about a third of what it normally is. And Case says that this is part of the story about why the housing market is so weak.
People are doubling up. They're staying with mom and dad. They're not coming here, and the immigration figures are showing it's down.
Kay says problems in the housing market actually even affect marriage and divorce rates.
There's a great song that Loudon Wainwright in his new album called I Can't Sell My House.
There's no way we could sell our house now, so we'll have to stay. And you can't up and walk out on me, and I can't run away.
If they could split up, that would create another household, demand for another apartment or another house.
There's actually a new paper in the American Economic Review this month that finds the marriage rate sensitive to changes in house price. So this decision to form a household is a major component of demand.
So the hope is that this slowdown in household formation is creating some pent-up demand for housing. People want to move out of their parents' basement, or at least their parents want them to move out. Young couples want to settle down, get married, or get rid of their roommates. Other people want to get divorced and split up. Nariman Baravesh is chief economist of the forecasting firm IHS.
One way to think about it is the longer household formation stays down, the greater the pent-up demand. And it's like a rubber band. You keep pulling back on it. At some point when you let it go, it's going to snap back in a very big way.
Baravesh thinks that next summer the housing market could start to pick up quite a bit. Other economists say it won't happen that soon. In the meantime, though, the housing market remains a pretty big mess. And there are a lot of people who, for better or for worse, can't sell their houses. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
Suppose we got a buyer. We could go our separate ways and consider all our time together just a passing phase.
It's time once again for the latest in our series on the sounds of summer.
It's summertime.
Writer Bailey White lives in southern Georgia, and as she tells it, her summer sound ends when the season really begins.
Every early spring, I look forward to the first night singing of the Chuck Wills Widow. My mother used to note down the date of the first singing each year in the margins of Herbert L. Stoddard's book, Birds of Grady County. When I hear it for the first time, I make my ritual move from the winter bedroom to the sleeping porch. What a joy it is to be out of that claustrophobic bedroom and back on the spring-cleaned porch. The fragrance of wild azaleas, moonlight in the pines, and all through the woods, the merry night song. Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow. The Chuck Wills' Widow is a large brown bird in the nightjar family. It eats insects and sometimes small songbirds, which it swallows whole. The male bird's loud night singing and the female's practice of laying her eggs in a flimsy nest flat on the ground make the Chuck Wills' Widow vulnerable to predators. In early spring, the song is a joy to hear wafting through the woods. But as spring heads into summer, the singing of certain individuals becomes faster, breathless, frenetic, and a constant refrain. Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow. In South Georgia, winter and spring are famously magical seasons. Rich people from Philadelphia and Cleveland used to flock to my town each winter and called it paradise. But summer is a dreaded season. Smothering heat, long spells of heartbreaking drought, stink bugs in the roses, rattlesnakes under the steps, and a wasp nest in every aluminum gate. These are the things I think about as the Chuck Wills' Widow's song becomes desperate. One hot night he was singing so loud, so pitifully hopeful, I could not sleep. Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wills' Widow, Chuck Wick. Something had grabbed him in mid-song. There was a flap of wings, then crunching and smacking. Spring is over, I thought, and now summer is here.
A summer sound from writer Bailey White. If you have a summer sound you'd like to share, go to npr.org and click on Contact Us. And please be sure to put summer sounds in that subject line.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A lot of struggling math students have found comfort in the sound of this man's voice.
Welcome to the presentation on using the quadratic equation.
Salman Khan started making math videos to help tutor his cousin, but they became so popular he quit his job with a hedge fund to work on them full time. Now his online Khan Academy attracts countless teachers and students. NPR's Larry Abramson reports on the first effort to bring Khan's approach into the classroom.
It is shocking. Three dissolute students in Northern California are using school time to play a computer game. What's it called?
Trigonometry challenge.
Yeah.
Okay, one half. What? 2x? Oh, yeah, okay.
Fifth graders Michael Ahn, Lucas Nguyen, and Reese Toomrey are actually hip-deep in the trigonometry challenge at Khan Academy. They're gobbling up math problems like a plate of Doritos. This school is part of a pilot program at Santa Rita Elementary School in Los Altos, California. They're making the Khan Academy an integral part of the math curriculum. Teacher Cami Thorderson says for half an hour a day, Khan Academy dunks these students into a completely self-paced world.
They're all in different places. Some of them are working on calculus in high school math. Some of them are working on multiplication of decimals. And that's okay.
It's okay because students who need help can look up the appropriate video and listen to the Academy's explanation of concepts like direct and inverse variation.
So I'll do direct variation on the left over here, and I'll do inverse variation, or two variables that vary inversely, on the right-hand side over here. So
Salman Khan scribbles on the video screen and guides students along with his signature approach, patient and unthreatening. Cami Thorderson says kids are comfortable turning to Khan for help.
It's kind of a private thing. It's not like you have to raise your hand in front of the whole class and say, I don't get this. You can go not get it on your own and nobody needs to know about it.
There's nothing flashy about the videos or the exercises, but somehow Khan has clearly hit a sweet spot that makes this the most popular part of the day.
So that you square that, that's 36, and you square that, that's 9.
Cami Thorderson says during Khan time, her class looks more like a busy engineering office than a traditional classroom. Kids collaborate, the teacher facilitates, and she doesn't have to lecture. Some kids, like Hannah Albright, work on their own, following online exercises as they do calculations on a whiteboard or with pencil and paper.
90 minus 7, and that would be 83.
It's like an online teacher. They can help you anywhere.
You can go as fast as you want.
Yeah.
Right?
You don't have to wait.
Yeah.
Are we going to do I Need Help?
Next door, in Kelly Rafferty's class, kids put their name on the board. Some want help on a concept. Others offer to teach something that they've mastered. Rafferty says that Khan helps her deal with the big class sizes that even this affluent district is facing.
Khan has definitely helped me reach all of the students. So when you have that many kids, you end up sort of teaching to the middle. And Khan has allowed me to reach the lowest and the highest.
Much more than a textbook would, Rafferty says. Khan Academy also offers a kind of back office function. While kids are working independently on exercises, Rafferty checks her computer to see how they're doing.
So with this, I can look at all the kids and I can see who's struggling, who's not, which they passed, how many it took for them to pass. So it gives me a lot more information.
Information she can use to see who needs extra help. Santa Rita Elementary principal Sandra McGonigal says for her, the Khan Academy has some big advantages over other math materials.
One, it's free, and it's created by people who really just love math, and the quality is so great.
After this year's pilot program, the Los Altos schools are going to start using Khan Academy district-wide for 5th and 6th grade. The Khan Academy is hoping to see how this experiment plays out in a wider range of schools. They expand to at least 10 new schools next year. Math class may never be the same.
Okay, yeah.
Larry Abramson, NPR News.
And you can expect lower gas prices this summer. One reason, the White House is tapping the nation's strategic petroleum reserve. Over the next month, the administration will sell 30 million barrels of government oil. NPR's Jeff Brady has more.
The administration says this is part of an international effort to address supply concerns. Trouble in Libya means there's 1.5 million fewer barrels of oil on the market each day. Combine that with the busy summer driving season, and the administration worries prices could start inching back up. Patrick Dehan with GasBuddy.com says tapping the reserve should send prices below the current national average of $3.61 a gallon.
The national average has already been moving lower almost every day here for the past 5 or 6 weeks or so. That will likely continue. We may see some accelerated drops here in the next week or so.
As the government oil works its way through the market, the East and West Coast likely will benefit the most. Philip Verleger at the University of Calgary says that's because prices in the middle of the U.S. already are benefiting from extra supply, largely because of Canada's oil sands.
Consumers in the Midwest will not see as much because the price in the Midwest has already been much lower.
Lower oil prices everywhere means lower profits for oil companies. That sent their share prices down Thursday. Still, administration officials say if gas prices start going up again, they could decide to release even more oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Jeff Brady, NPR News.